Anyone who's ever taken an American history class knows about the 13 colonies. But there's more to that geographic and historic story.
We have forgotten that there were actually more than 13 colonies in North America.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we open up our own history class and take another look at West Florida, the forgotten 14th colony. We'll also spend an academic minute with some transgender history. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When Betsy Ross designed that flag with 13 stars and 13 stripes, everyone at the time knew that there was a lot more land out there and there would likely be additions coming. However, at the time, there was already a functioning 14th colony on the Gulf Coast, and it had changed hands between Spain and Great Britain a few times, with France thrown in there around the edges. That's the story Mike Bunn tells in his fascinating book called 14th Colony, The Forgotten Story of the Gulf South During America's Revolutionary Era. Mike Bunn is director of historic Blakely State Park in Spanish Fort, Alabama. We spoke last spring, and I asked him why he wanted to tell the story of the colony of West Florida.
Well, it was for that very reason that you just mentioned. It is a fascinating story. It's one that most people have very little familiarity with, and I'll admit I did not either. And when I learned about it, and the more I researched it, and the more I read about it, the more I realized there was a real opportunity to add to the historiography of this region and tell a story that most people really did not know all the details about, and I thought it was interesting to boot, so that's what I did.
So people can picture it in their minds here. Just give an outline of just where was West Florida.
West Florida was bounded on the west by the Mississippi River, south by the Gulf of Mexico, east at the Apalachicola River, and on the north originally at the 31st parallel, which is just north of Mobile, and then later, a year later after they founded it, they moved the border up to the 32nd parallel, which is where the Yazoo River meets the Mississippi. So we're talking Vicksburg, Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, Montgomery, Alabama, Columbus, Georgia. That would be the northern boundary that was established in 1764.
This is actually a huge hunk of land, wasn't it?
It was, and it incorporated portions of four southern states. So it's although the name of the colony is West Florida, a lot of people get that geographic reference stuck in their head, and they think we're talking specifically about the Pensacola area. But in truth, it was a large swath of the Gulf Coast, and it was the western portion of what the British referred to loosely as Florida, with the eastern portion being the peninsula of Florida, and that was a separate colony. There were West and East Florida divided by the Apalachicola River.
And why is this so unknown? Is it just because it didn't really last that long?
Well, the reasons it is unknown are multiple. The primary one, the main one, and really the reason that sparked the title of the book was the fact that the colony did not rise in rebellion against Great Britain during the American Revolution. We know the 13 colonies that did, and we know they formed a new nation, and we have forgotten, because of that fact, that there were actually more than 13 colonies in North America. And so I think that is the number one reason among several. It had a elected government, but that government did not meet regularly and was not the voice of the people the way it was in some other places. That's part of it. It was had a relatively small population. That's another part of the story. And there's several other reasons, but that is probably the primary reason, is this, that anything beyond 13 seems to be extraneous in our memory, our collective memory of the American Revolution.
With its location, I mean, it basically took up the Gulf Coast, the northern Gulf Coast. It seems like it would be valuable, worth fighting for.
Well, it was, and it ultimately, the British did fight for it, but they were fighting the Spanish for it instead of the United States. There was an American campaign into the region that was relatively small and of limited scope. But the war between the Spanish, who owned the colony of Louisiana just across the Mississippi River to the west of West Florida, and the British, who were trying to hold on to that colony, ended up being a multi-year, multi-battle war with some just fascinating military conflicts all across the Gulf Coast from Louisiana into what is now Alabama, two major conflicts there. And then, of course, with the final siege resulting in the capture of Pensacola. So the Spanish, over a three-year period, essentially took over the colony of West Florida by military force. It's a forgotten campaign in the American Revolution that really influenced a whole lot of trajectory of this area's history.
I was going to say, was that actually considered part of the American Revolution since they were fighting the Spanish?
Yes, because Great Britain was, of course, defending its territory against Spain, who was allied with France, who was allied with the United States. Now, Spain did not want to officially endorse the concept of American independence. They were still a colonial power, but they very much were interested in taking back any land that they could from the British, which they'd lost. Land to at the end of the Seven Years' War. That's how the colony was created. So they were looking for an opportunity to take advantage of a distracted rival, and any forces that the British were forced to send to this area were forces that could have been used in other places. And the Spanish were covertly supporting the American war effort through private and some limited government means in the war. So it's sort of a tangled alliance. It's not an open campaign the same way that George Washington's armies were involved in, but it definitely is a part of that larger picture. And the Americans were very much delighted to see a new campaign being opened on the Gulf that would tie down extra resources in this region.
So you do mention that it had a government. Was it a functioning colony with a functioning government and rules and regs and everything else?
Sure. It sure was. West Florida had a governor, an appointed governor, and it had he was advised by an appointed council, and that council served as the upper house of the legislature when he called the legislature into session. The lower house was elected by districts. So they did have a representative government. A little detail there that we forget, though, is that representative government essentially functioned as such when the governor called them into session, and they chose over the period of some 20 years of the colony's existence to call it into session very few times. So it was more often than not governed by the governor and his council, but there was a lower house of elected representatives, and it was the first true elected government, representative government, that was brought into being on the Gulf Coast.
What was the seat of government for this colony?
Pensacola was the capital of West Florida throughout the time period. There were only two major communities in the colony for most of its existence, Mobile and Pensacola. And Pensacola was declared to be the capital, the seat of government, when it was founded, and it remained so. It remained the main port throughout the time period. And Mobile was a city that enjoyed a lot of commercial advantages and was about the same size, if not even larger, than Pensacola during the time period. But the seat of government stayed in Pensacola.
One thing you do mention in the book, that there was no public school system in the colony. What kind of school system was there?
Not much of any school system, to tell you the truth. The people who had the opportunity and the means would send their children, they would either have them privately tutored or send them off to other places where they could be educated elsewhere in the colonies and abroad. But there was no functioning public school system. These were the type of things that the British clearly wanted to have developed in the colony at some point. Remember, it was founded in 1763. The first governor arrives in 1764. It grows very slowly for about a decade. And then it suddenly evolved in this continental, almost worldwide conflict of the American Revolution that consumes it from about 1775, 76, all the way until the very last days of its time under the British flag. So it was a Herculean effort. They were essentially trying to build a colony from scratch. And some of the things that they wanted to do, they simply just never got around to implementing.
And interestingly, you say that after everything was being split up after the war, that Britain held out some faint hope of actually keeping the colony.
They did. International treaties, especially during the 18th century, between these worldwide colonial powers had a way of having some rather strange negotiations at times. And the British, who were negotiating this treaty to establish the new United States, and they realized they had lost portion of their colonial holdings to the Spanish by force of arms, it was not certain, but they did have some slight hope that in some way, shape, or form, they might be able to hold on to portion of that through diplomacy, but it was not to be. Spain was very, very determined to hold on to what they had taken, and so British West Florida becomes Spanish West Florida right after the war, and would remain so all the way up until the very last portions are finally acquired by the United States well into the 1800s. So the Spanish period has a long and interesting story to itself that's beyond the scope of the book, but that Spanish era on the Gulf Coast begins with the capture of Pensacola in May of 1781, continues all the way up until Florida becomes a territory in about 1819.
Was the colony of West Florida, did it stay intact during all that time, or was it being chipped away?
It stayed intact. The West Florida was an intact colony from the time it was created in 1763 up until the gradual piecemeal acquisition by the United States in the 1800s. Now, there is one little caveat to that, is that the British, you know, when their first boundary was the 31st parallel, the northern boundary of the colony, and then the next year, they moved that border north. Well, at the end of the American Revolution, the Spanish were attempting to govern this new colony they had captured and honor the exact same boundaries that the British had expanded it to. And in the treaty ending the war of the United States, the language in the treaty specified that the southern boundary of the United States in the region would be back to that 31st parallel, as originally was the original northern boundary of the colony. That was a disputed issue that Spain and the United States were at odds about for over a decade. The Spanish were finally brought to the negotiating table in 1795 about it. They signed the Treaty of San Lorenzo. They agreed to give that back to the United States and withdraw down to below the 31st parallel. They finally withdrew in 1798. And all that is important because as soon as they withdrew from that contested strip of territory, the United States took formal control of the first portion of this area that it actually controlled and created a new territory out of it. And they called it the Mississippi Territory. So that is the origins of the states of Mississippi and Alabama right there.
I imagine all that coastline must have had the newly formed U.S. wanting that territory to get access to the coast.
Very much, very much. And it would only be just a few years before they were making active efforts to do it, you know, in the Louisiana Purchase. The American negotiators tried to sort of twist the language in that to say that the treaty was giving that swath of land that was formerly part of the French colony Louisiana, and they're making the case that French Louisiana actually extended even over to the Perdido River, and in truth, in some ways, it did. So they were trying diplomacy to acquire portions of this area. What ultimately happened, though, was that there was some small-scale rebellion within the territory fomented by Americans who had moved there, who who basically took over one of the Spanish outposts at Baton Rouge in 1810. You've got an independent Republic of West Florida that the United States quickly annexes into the state of Louisiana, the future state of Louisiana. And then portions of the rest of that coastline come into American possession piecemeal. And where I'm sitting today in Mobile, Mobile area, that came into United States possession as a direct acquisition during the War of 1812. And it was the only territorial acquisition United States made, but they laid formal claim at threat of arms to the Spanish in 1813, and the Spanish realized they were not prepared to fight a major battle in Mobile to hold on to that piece of land. And so you've got this piecemeal acquisition that will continue after that when you get into the story of the development of the state of Florida and the Seminole War, when Andrew Jackson goes over to Pensacola and eventually brings the Spanish to the negotiating table with the treaty of the Adams-Onis Treaty. So it's a long, detailed story about how that colony was eventually divided up and came into American possession.
It seems like by that time, the colony had become just a nuisance to Spain.
In some ways, it had, because Spain was on the decline as a world power, even as it was winning these battles against Great Britain. It would only be a short time later before they realized that they no longer had the resources to support a worldwide colonial effort in the way that the British could do. And it was a constant struggle to hold on to what they had and what they tried to do to counter their lack of resources and manpower was to ingratiate themselves with the local populace, have very generous terms for settlement, on and on. And ultimately, they sort of lost it from within because there was really no effective fighting force that the Spanish could bring to bear should any serious threat rise up. And we saw that back in 1810 when a ragtag American force just sort of takes over the government and a fort at Baton Rouge. And I'm exaggerating a little bit of that, but the truth is Spain was ill-prepared to make any strong military defense of its holdings it acquired after the American Revolution and would only grow weaker as the years went by. And so that story of what happened to that British colony under Spanish administration is a fascinating chapter unto itself in the Gulf Coast's history.
There's one line towards the very end of the book that I just want to quote here because I love it. You say, in a dramatic period of less than a decade, regional maps had to be drawn at dizzying rapidity. It was that changing that quick, huh?
Yeah, it really was. And you know, it was just year by year almost, things were being reformed, remapped, borders were moving around. And it's a really complicated but really intriguing portion of the Gulf Coast shared heritage, that the era between the founding of British West Florida and the really when the last portions of colonial control were actually relinquished and it all becomes American. That little era, which I focused on a portion of it with the book, with the British period, but that's one of the most intriguing and intrigued one of the most complex periods of Gulf Coast history.
Still to come, our conversation with Mike Bunn continues with a look at Native American life in the colony of West Florida. That part of the story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Mike Bunn, director of historic Blakely State Park in Spanish Fort, Alabama. We're listening again to my conversation with him about his book called 14th Colony, The Forgotten Story of the Gulf South During America's Revolutionary Era. We've been talking about the British and the Spanish and the French and, of course, the colonists. But what about the Native Americans living in the region at the time? What was life like for them?
Well, that's a good question, and I will say from the outset that I specifically in the book wanted to investigate what the British were doing who actually established this colony, because I will offer that I think we actually probably know more about the day-to-day life of the Native Americans at the time than we did the European settlers. But in general, and these are very general terms, this was a time period in which the Creeks and the Choctaws enjoyed some relative autonomy and were reaping the benefits of being involved in this international trade for skins and guns and tools that they received in turn. It's a time period in which they probably had as much authority and self-direction as any other time when they're dealing with Europeans. Now, shortly after that, that situation is gradually going to become more and more one-sided, especially after the United States wins its independence and Americans are looking to expand westward, and you're having fewer European nations to deal with. It was a time in which they could negotiate one European power against another to reach the best deal for themselves. So in general, it's a really intriguing time period when they enjoyed some power that just a generation later would be, the situation was almost entirely reversed. But they drastically had more people, more population than the settlers on the Gulf Coast at any given point in this time period. You're talking about maybe 1765, you may have 2,500 European or non-Native American, European and African slaves that lived in the colony. At any given point in that era, you would have had at least 30,000 Creek and Choctaw residents just to their north. So it was a different dynamic than what would be coming just a few decades later with American expansion into the region.
Well, this is after the time period you cover in the book, but by the time Florida became a state in 1845, was just any of the borders from this colony gone? Were they all gone?
Yeah, the one remnant of the time period, there are two remnants in Florida's borders that are really directly related to this general time period that I talk about. One is that 31st parallel border, which is the border between Florida and Alabama, that north-south border. That goes all the way back to that original creation of the colony of British West Florida, 31st parallel, and of course, it goes back again to what I talked about with after the war, when the United States wanted Spain to relinquish that northern expansion of the colony and move back down to that 31st parallel. So that border is historically significant in the fact that it was disputed for several years and goes back to really to 1763. And the other border that is significant is that dates to the general time period is the Perdido River, which is the border, east-west border between Florida and Alabama today. Baldwin County, Alabama is on the west side of that. And that river was recognized as sort of the unofficial boundary between the French colony of Louisiana, which was first headquartered at Mobile, and the Spanish colony of Florida, with a settlement in Pensacola, going all the way back to the early 1700s. So that border, those two that we have, are remnants of this colonial period.
Well, one of these days, someone is going to explain to me why this strip of land of Florida that's in the central time zone is actually still part of Florida.
Well, it wasn't for lack of trying to give it away. There were more than one effort to acquire it by Alabama. It was actually offered a time or two, and they didn't see that it was going to be very productive at the time. It's hard to believe, but they didn't think it was a very productive land and would be a more of a problem to administer. And then there were some other efforts later, back, going all the way fast forward to the 1890s, in which that momentum gained a little traction again, which is, again, a story unto itself. But there were negotiations going all the way back to Alabama statehood about whether or not that portion of the Florida Panhandle that's just south of Alabama's border might be included into the state of Alabama. So well, there's so many other stories that branch out of that colonial era. But, yeah, that was definitely something that has been discussed a few times in Alabama and Florida's history.
Again, the name of Mike Bunn's book is 14th Colony, The Forgotten Story of the Gulf South During America's Revolutionary Era. It's published by New South Books. Transgender people have been slowly gaining more rights and acceptance in the U.S., at least in urban areas. But what about rural America? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Trans rights are becoming more mainstream in cities, but what about rural areas? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Samantha Rosenthal, associate professor of history at Roanoke College, finds out.
When I moved to Appalachia, I didn't know what I would find. As a trans woman who researches and writes about transgender people, I wanted to know, what is the history of trans people here? Do trans histories exist? Not just in New York and San Francisco, but in forgotten places like Southwest Virginia. Then I met Carolyn. She grew up in rural West Virginia in the 50s and 60s. She says, I always been Carolyn from 5 all the way up to 67, but I always know the way I was. At 21, she moved to Roanoke, where she began performing on stages and working downtown as a sex worker. She was the first Black queen to win a major pageant here in 1975. When we interviewed her 43 years later, she said, transgender wasn't a thing back then, but if it was, she would have been it. And there was Rhoda, a white woman. She grew up in Roanoke in the 1950s. While at college, Rhoda underwent a battery of psychological tests, and a doctor ultimately prescribed her with estrogen and progestin. By the time she took the stage in Roanoke in 1977, she had visible breasts. She changed her legal ID. She was preparing to marry a man. I'm a transsexual, a woman, she said. Ever since I can remember, that's the way I've felt. These days, activists sometimes chant, trans people exist. It's a fact supported by history. Not just in big cities, but in small ones and towns across America, where transgender history is a story just waiting to be told.
That was Samantha Rosenthal of Roanoke College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.